evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And along with K2 KEY Mel, we run a thing called the TechNet. It's a gathering of the clan in which ham radio operators get together and help each other. We explain how all this complicated hardware works. There's wireless equipment. We teach each other how to make better antennas, what transmitters and receivers to use, what feed lines to use, why do they work the way they work. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are the subjects you bring as questions or comments. So, most of the time, it's your subjects. Any subject of interest to ham radio operators is usually appropriate for the technical net. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes or no, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net if you say yes. Typical sign-in would sign like this, K2KEY, Eric, and yes. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2 Alex, if you're listening.
This is KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe in the mobile. And no, at this time, no.
K2YO, Bernie, no.
AF2RF, no. Handle is Bennett.
NU1Y, Dwayne, no traffic.
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Okay, so far we've got Mel, Joe, Bernie, Bennett, Dwayne. There was another very weak signal which I wasn't able to get. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KP1NNH, Jerry, no traffic.
Jerry recognizes enough.
B1BYY, Howard, yes.
Okay, the B1Y or something with the yes, give me that full call letters and name again, sir.
W2-G1BYY, I'm a visitor from England, hence the prefix to my UK call sign.
Okay, your audio is very low, so you have to talk a little bit louder. Whiskey 2 blank, Baker Yankee Yankee is what I'm hearing. I think you sent an unusual prefix, and I'm missing your full call letters and name, sir. So please try again.
Sorry, I'll try and shout it. It's Whiskey 2 / Golf 1 Bravo Yankee Yankee. I'm from England. My name is Howard.
Very fine, Howard, from the UK. Howard, out of curiosity, do you think you will have a question or a comment for the net?
Yes, I'd like to, if that's this time available. From B2-G1BYY.
Fantastic. Okay, we got a live one. We got a person with a real question. So far, to my knowledge, everyone signing in had no question, and Howard will be the first when we come back to him. Anyone else to check in, particularly with questions or comments? Give me your call letters and your name and that yes right now.
KC2MDP, name is Steve, and yes.
Kilo 2, Echo Victor Delta, Brian, yes.
Okay, we've got a couple more live ones. Steve with a yes, and Brian with a yes. Fantastic. Okay, more than enough to get started. Howard, what brings you from the UK? Possibly you're here on holiday, as they would say, on the continent, and give us enough audio, and you'll have to get used to our accent. So please give us enough audio and go right ahead with your question or comment. Whiskey 2 / Golf 1 Baker Yankee Yankee. Howard to take it, K2RAW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Yes, thanks very much. I'm here with my fiance, who lives here. She lives in New York. We met on the internet, and I come over here when I can to spend time here. Do you want me to go ahead with my question from B2-G1BYY?
Absolutely, Howard. Fire away with your question, sir.
Okay. Back in England, I recently bought a
1-2-3-4-5
used as a mobile emergency communications. I'm a member of RayNet, which is the equivalent of your area. It has with antennas through the fiberglass roof. and the previous owner put aluminium foil strips to act as ground planes. Now, they don't seem to be doing much of a job, so I'm asking for information on what I need to do to improve that so the widths work properly. Over here.
Okay. What I think I'm hearing is that the fiberglass roof of the vehicle you're speaking of doesn't really present a very good counterpoise, a ground plane to operate the antenna. And the antenna itself, I guess, is the equivalent of a mag mount or whatever. In other words, a quarter wave-like antenna, which does require a counterpoise. A real dipole, dipole in free space, you could, if you want to, set up a sheet of metal normal to the dipole, right through the center, so that, you know, half of the dipole sticks out the right-hand side, half the dipole sticks out the left-hand side of this sheet of metal. Because there's an equipotential voltage right at the center, the sheet of metal would do nothing. It would not change the pattern, the gain, the impedance, or whatever of the dipole if you did that. Then if you want to, you could take the right-hand side of the dipole and that sheet of metal and feed it independently and throw away the left-hand side of the dipole. Do that, and you and I call that a quarter-wave ground plane antenna. Set it up properly, and we call it a vertical ground plane. So the sheet of metal is the counterpoise. Ordinarily, the way the dipole works is that the feed line and the transmitter is pumping electrons from the left side of the dipole toward the right side of the dipole on the first half cycle, and on the second half cycle, it pumps them back. And now, with only the sheet of metal there, the missing portion of the dipole is presented as a mirror image, and you have to draw current from the counterpoise, the sheet of metal, so to speak. Without the sheet of metal, you do not have a resonant quarter wave antenna. The other half of the dipole without the sheet of metal is not there. And so, as people set up ground plane antennas in their backyard, there's a lot of discussion taking place as to whether or not 4 ground plane radials are adequate, or should you really go all the way and put 32 or 64 of them. You're trying to make your backyard in that case look like an infinite ground plane of conducting copper. Now, on that automobile, let me drop. On that automobile with the fiberglass roof and just putting down some aluminum strips, if the aluminum strips were in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength long and there's enough of them, that could be made to work. The reason why you have to put a lot of ground plane radials in the backyard is that the RF energy that can sneak in between the ground plane radials, it sees the earth as a distributed, resistive, three-dimensional substance, and it dissipates RF energy. In the wintertime, you'd be heating up the ground, so to speak, if you don't have enough ground plane radials, and keeping the worms warm. So when the quarter-wave ground plane is elevated, like it is, for instance, on a station master antenna or a repeater antenna, then 3 ground plane radials are adequate because there is no earth in between those radials for the RF to see, and there is no loss mechanism. So your automobile presents a situation midway between those two. You're not thoroughly, you know, a large distance above the earth, and you have other lossy materials within the automobile itself. Now, here's my recommendation, my guess as to what might give you a solution, Howard, and that is, a number of people stateside have set up an extremely effective 20-meter vertical antenna on the balcony of their apartment building that's, say, 10 or 20 floors above New York City. And they've done it by wrapping the radiator into a spiral structure that makes it shorter physically but electrically longer. And they've wound it in such a way that it is electrically a half wavelength long, not a quarter wavelength long. The magic of a half-wave dipole, and you don't have to feed the dipole from the center. It is perfectly legal to feed the dipole from the outer tip, from one of the edges. The only disadvantage of doing that is you're now feeding 1,000 ohm impedance as opposed to the 70 ohm impedance when you feed the center. But the fact that you're feeding one end and feeding 1,000 ohms means that the integrity required for the ground plane radial system, the amount of ground plane radial system, drastically decreases. Many guys have set up that half-wave resonator, spiral-wound 20-meter vertical antenna by using nothing but the metal railing, the safety railing.
Repeater, timeout.
They've used nothing but the metal railing on their balcony as the counterpoise, and they've ended up with extremely high efficiency. So, as you make your radiator section on that vehicle longer, physically longer, or I should say electrically longer. Electrically longer can be done with a loading coil or making the whip longer or whatever. As you go towards 5/8 wave or in the vicinity of a half wave length, the need for the counterpoise almost disappears. That's the good news. The bad news is that depending on how you create that extra electrical length, it might require extra physical length or a loading coil. So it's a little bit of a mechanical, difficulty required. And you're now feeding the tip of the antenna where the impedance is much higher. So some form of impedance step-up device is required. If you study the way mag-mount 5/8 wave automobile antennas work, it is one of these. There's a simple coil at the bottom that's simultaneously the loading coil, and the coax cable center conductor is tapped up one turn on that to get the impedance step up from 50 ohms to 1,000. So, as I see it, you've got a number of possible choices. Make sure that the strips of aluminum, there's enough of them, and they're a quarter wave long. That's one approach. Make the radiator itself longer and re-impedance match. I would choose the second, because anyone who has ever run a half wave or 5/8 wave whip from an automobile usually says that the performance is considerably higher, a little bit more gain on the horizon, and as long as the whip is not touching the top of the garage or the local trees, it has worked out very well for people. I wonder if that makes some sense, Howard, what I've said so far. W2/G1 Baker Yankee Yankee, K2RIW listening.
W2/G1DYY returning. Thanks very much, Dick. That's fascinating. I've been making notes as you were talking. The only thing I'm a bit...
D-Y-D-Y-D-Dispect.
I have there at the moment are designed to go through a metal vehicle roof. And the problem being that it's a fiberglass roof, so hence the discussion. I'll see if I can get the engineering to have a go at making one, but I'm not sure if my metalwork is up to it. If I go for the ground plane idea, is there any issue with using, say, a metal grid rather than actually solid metal for the ground plane? I'm not sure how big I can make it. A quarter wave may be an issue because of the structure of the roof. There are things in the way that I can't move. A terrific lot of information there, and thank you very much for it. I should be listening further. K2RIW, W2/G1BYY.
Very fine, Howard. I'm wearing earphones, and I'm hearing everything you're saying, but some of the other people on this repeater might not be. I think some of the repeaters in the United Kingdom use a reasonably narrow, I guess, 2 or 3 kilohertz of deviation. I think we favor more like 5 or 6 kilohertz of deviation. So I recommend you get a little closer to the mic and or talk a little louder so that other people can hear your audio. And there's a little bit of hiss in the background as far as the RF strength is concerned, but no picket fencing. When it comes to the counterpoise, the sheet of metal that works against a quarter-wave resonator-type antenna, to make that out of mesh is perfectly acceptable. It doesn't have to be really a sheet of metal. I just use that as an example to get the concept across about the fact that the other half of the dipole is a mirror image in that sheet of metal. As far as the radio signal is concerned, a mesh or screening will act like a sheet of metal as long as the diameter of the holes, the square or rectangular or round holes between the mesh rods and, horizontal and vertical rods, so to speak, as long as that those holes are small enough to be what's called waveguide beyond cutoff. That's a fancy way of saying if the horizontal dimension and the vertical dimension of each of the holes are less than a quarter wave in length. What do you think about that? Oh, less than half wave. That's right. You need half wave of length to a piece of waveguide in order to propagate a signal. So as long as they're half wave or significantly less than half wave spacing, then the mesh will be act like a solid chunk of copper as far as the radio signal is concerned. If you did make the mesh out of horizontal and vertical rods, it's hard to believe that the G1 junction between the horizontal and vertical rods does not have to be soldered. The horizontal rods will reflect the horizontal polarized portion of the wave, the vertical rods will reflect the vertical, and a slant polarization between those two is really a combination of horizontal and vertical, and the individual components will be reflected. So making it out of mesh, perfectly acceptable. And does it have to be exactly a quarter wavelength long? Now life gets a little bit more complicated there. If the equivalent of the ground plane radial are less than quarter wave, then your so-called counterpoise will be acting like the other half of the dipole as a flat dipole
repeater. Time out.
The counterpoise will be acting like a fat dipole, so to speak, with a top hat capacitor, a very short half of the other half of the dipole. And that's a fancy way of saying that if the counterpoise has a radial dimension less than a quarter wavelength long, it will become RF hot. It'll be an unbalanced dipole. You could, if you want to, make a dipole where the left side is fatter or longer or shorter than the right-hand side. And in general, the side that's the shortest becomes a little bit hotter with RF energy. And you'd like the counterpoise at the roof of the vehicle to not be hot with RF energy, if at all possible. So I would favor making the radiator electronically longer by a loading coil or extending the whip and re-impedance matching. There's probably a commercial product you can buy that comes close to fulfilling all the requirements that I'm describing, but I think the main thing you desire here is a little bit of a theory of what you're trying to do and how to make it work better. Almost any piece of metal with a slot in it, or any piece of metal as a radiator, can be made into an antenna if you're smart enough and properly impedance match it. The main thing you have to do is first resonate. The hard thing to gather that's not well illustrated in any of the antenna books we read is that a radiating system must first resonate, then it can radiate. Resonance is defined as an impedance match that has no reactance to it. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that the RF energy really has to bounce back and forth 20 times in a full dipole before it's radiated. It doesn't all get radiated on the first pass through the dipole. It reflects back and forth between the ends. RF energy really does do that. It's got a Q of 20, roughly. You can measure the bandwidth of a dipole. You can confirm that. You can measure the rise time and the fall time. A brief signal to put in there. You'll again confirm it. What resonance is really defined as is that keeping all of those bounces in step with each other. Make the antenna a little bit too long, and they start lagging in phase, and we say the antenna is inductive. Make the antenna too short, they start leading in phase, all those bounces, and we say the antenna is capacitive. So you resonate the antenna first, then you can radiate. If you want to go one step further, let me drop. Resonance really is resonance of the total radiating system. That consists of antenna, impedance matching at the antenna if there is one, transmission line, antenna tuner in the shack or inside the passenger compartment of the car if you're using one. That total radiating system must be resonated before you can do an efficient job of radiating. So by adjusting ground plane sizes, radiator, the radiating element sizes, and impedance matching, if you finally get the two structures to come together and be electronically resonant, properly impedance matched, and maybe going toward 5/8 wave, and the length of the radiator is one way to go. There's many ways to do it, as you can tell, and I'm trying to give you a little bit of a feeling for what you're attempting to do in this case. Give us a little bit more audio if you possibly can, Howard. I'm just going to give you the G1 Baker Yankee Yankee to take it, K2RIW listening.
W2/G1DYY returning. Sorry about the audio. I've got a bit of a sore throat, and I find it difficult to speak any louder, but I'm doing my best. Using a handheld here on about 3 or 4 watts, so I'm getting into the video, I believe, okay, but there's not a lot there to help out, I'm afraid. Okay, very good information, thank you. I've got one of the MSJ antenna analyzers, so hopefully I can use that to work out what I'm doing. Find out what I'm doing as I do it. So I shall have to experiment with that and see what I can do. I'm just trying to think of some way of physically connecting the thing without it getting too big. the vehicle itself is very tall already, so adding extra length to the width could be a problem with going under bridges and such. But I'll see what I can do for that. Loading coil sounds the better idea, to be honest. Deal with it lower down and without taking up digging the great way overhead. So, thank you very much for your information. I shall work out looking at it if anybody else could be asking questions, but I shall listen to you intently. K2RIW from G1BYY.
Very fine, Howard. You may not have to physically lengthen the whip. I'm recommending if you electronically lengthen it. In other words, go in the direction toward half wave electronically, which usually means adding a loading coil at the bottom. So therefore, the current size whip could do it very well with that loading coil and a re-impedance match. And if you're going to be here long enough after you perform these experiments, please come back and let us know how it worked out. I am curious, with your handy talkie, on a quick break, Howard, where are you located? K2RIW.
I'm in a little village near Queens Boulevard. Can't think of the name of the other road. Can't remember, sorry. G1BYY.
Okay, I got a vague idea where you are. Very good. The next person who signed in was Steve, KC2MDP. He's a guy with a lot of audio. You're waiting here. Go ahead, Steve. What would you like to talk about tonight?
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening to everyone else out on the net there. Dick, I recently dug out this Yagi I built, a couple of years ago, out of the basement, you know. And I always wondered about this thing when I built it. It's a 9-element Yagi, and it's on 900 megahertz. And the first four elements look like a standard Yagi. Element 5, though, is slightly longer than element 4. And, I got it down here, and I'd say, 4, 6, through 9 are about the same size. Now, I used this Yagi, and I had pretty good success on it. I always wondered, though, that fifth element being longer than element 4, do you think that's a typo, or is this an improved design? Does this work? Back to you.
Good question, Steve. And the answer is yes and or no. There's an infinite number of ways of developing a Yagi design. There's no one Yagi design that's the absolute best. There are some Yagi designs that have a little bit more bandwidth. Some of them have a little bit better front-to-back ratio, a little bit higher gain, a little bit better first side lobe level. There's all kinds of Yagi designs, depending on what you feel like optimizing. Let me tell you what the Yagi is really doing. Each of those directors are a dipole-like structure that's a little bit shorter than a half wave long electronically. You can do it with loading coils and top hat capacitors and tapered elements and whatever, but electronically it is tuned higher than the operating frequency. Physically, electronically it's a little bit too short. Any antenna that's electronically too short, because that signal is going to bounce back and forth in there, even though it's a parasitic element, has no feed line to it, so to speak. When it's shorter than the resonant length, it ends up acting as a capacitor. If you were trying to feed signal to it, it would act like a capacitive load. A capacitive load is a slow wave structure. That's a fancy way of saying that the signal coming from free space when you're doing reception, the signal that travels down that boom and it encounters that particular director that we're now studying, and that director is a dipole-like element shorter than half wave, the wave becomes slowed. That's what I mean by a slow wave structure. So now, by adjusting the individual director lengths, you're adjusting how much slow wave phenomena.
Call from 4148.
When you adjust the individual director lengths, you're directing how much you're adjusting how much slow wave phenomena you get in that particular position in the boom. There also is some signal being fed back and forth between the elements. So the spacing of the elements changes the coupling coefficient. The length changes the slow wave structure. So with that as a raw piece of information, there's an infinite number of ways you can set up those directors. What you're trying to do is develop a certain graph of slow waveness for each individual position on the boom. And when you make a plot of how slowed is the wave in that position on the boom, where the position on the boom is the horizontal axis of this plot, and the vertical axis, we're putting a bunch of dots there as to how much the wave is slowed down in that area, and then we're going to collect the dots. We're going to connect the dots. The bottom line of what you get is a velocity profile. Vertical axis is velocity in that vicinity, horizontal axis is positioned on the boom, and you're looking for a particular shape. Once you realize how the Yagi works, every Yagi that has this exact same performance that I'm in my particular example, assume I've got a Yagi that I really like. I love its front-to-back ratio. I like its front main lobe beam width. I like its side lobe levels. I like its front-to-side level. I like everything about it. That particular Yagi has a particular velocity profile. I can take another Yagi built out of entirely different materials, fatter elements, printed circuit elements, elements that are loops instead of dipoles, triangles instead of dipoles, squares, so that it looks like a multi-element Yagi out of cubical quad. I can use all kinds of ways of making the parasitic elements. But after I finish making the physical design change, if I electrically readjust every one of those elements, so I come back to the same velocity profile, even though the new Yagi will look extremely different from the old one, it may have the exact same performance. The velocity profile is where the performance is located. Once you realize that, you realize that some guys will design Yagis where the length of the elements represents sort of a Coke bottle shape. Some of the Yagi designs will have elements that are shorter in the middle of the boom than the ones that are closer to the driven element and the ones that are close to the front end.
Repeater, time out.
There's an infinite number of ways of making a Yagi design, and some of those velocity profiles end up with a smaller velocity profile in the center of the boom than they do on the tips. So, is that a good design? Well, until you do a real good job of modeling it, you won't know, or put it into a good laboratory and test it. And in the case of a 900 mega antenna, I, on a daily basis, design 900 mega antennas with an antenna range that sits on my desk at the place of work. The antenna range is in between the desk and the conference table. I've got a bunch of anechoic material scattered around the room to stop the reflections off the file cabinets and off the floor and whatever. But I've developed a number of Yagi-like designs at 900 megacycles in a very small antenna range. So you could go out without too much effort and actually measure everything you want to know about that antenna. It's swept standing wave ratio. It swept gain. It swept front-to-back ratio. Swept versus frequency, what I'm talking about. Side lobe levels and so on. And you may discover that it's a good design, even though one of those elements or a number of them look like they're longer and it's opposite from what you have known as Yagi theory up to now. So your choices are to either empirically go and measure it, find out what's the origin of the design, does it have a real good father, if you know what I mean, or go to a computer model and find out if you like the way it performs, and maybe with the computer model, if it's got a high enough integrity, you can decide to start lengthening and shorting individual elements to find out what happens to the performance, and is it a performance that you like better. And by the way, you're not looking for a performance where all the side lobes go to zero. A lot of people listening to Mr. Seabick had that impression that that's something very desirable. It is not desirable to make all the side lobes go to zero. There's a particular amplitude of the side lobes that gives you maximum forward gain. But that's another whole discussion you didn't ask about. And already I've talked too long. Over to you, Steve. KC2 MGP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. You made that explanation quite well. I got the big picture now. Velocity factor, yes, I know that word quite well through experiments and stuff. Just one quick one, Dick. Antenna modeling program, you know, what's a good one? Is there any stuff I could download on the internet, freeware or anything? What's your idea of a decent modeling program that, you know, would be good for tinkering around, like you said, lengthening some elements, shortening some elements, you know, it'll give me gain, everything else, you know, give me an idea of what I'm doing. Back to you.
There are a couple of guys on this repeater who have done computer modeling. There are websites that will give you suggestions. Mr. Seabick did a whole lot of antenna modeling on what I think was either NEC or NEC2 or MINI-NEC. NEC stands for Numeric electronic code. So the NEC series of programs have developed an awful lot of respect. There's also the YO program, the Yagi Optimization Program. I, from personal experience, cannot tell you which computer modeling programs to use. I do not use them. I'm developing antennas that refuse to be modeled. It's my whole forte in life for the last few years. In other words, there's a certain style of Yagi-like structure where the modeling programs don't work well. But for what you're talking about, conventional Yagi elements built in a dipole-like structure, there are a number of programs out there that work quite well, quite respected, give results that once you do optimization with those programs and then go and physically build it, the performance you get when you build it is extremely close to what you model, and so there's a reasonably good closure there, if you know what I mean. Let's see if we've got anybody within the voice, within the sound of my voice right now, who will recommend a particular computer Yagi modeling program, and can also tell Steve where he can go and get it. Give me your call letters right now if you've got an answer for Steve. K2IW on the TechNet.
That's K2KEY, been using it for many years, Dick.
Mel is one guy. Anybody else?
I have a question. Another question, because I missed the list earlier.
Okay, that was Joe who didn't sign in, and we'll get him with a question. But first, Mel, what's your favorite modeling program, or the guys in the Kings County Radio Club, of which you're a past president, maybe even a present one, what program have they used, and how happy were they with it, and where did they get it? K2KEY for all of those answers and more. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, I'm the. This is my my own program that I own myself, and no, I did not get it from the club and all, but I've used it a number of times as reference and all. It's interesting to see, you know, model an antenna using that mini neck. I have the mini neck, one of the old ones, and you know what it is? It's a number of variables in it that are hard to work with, because remember, they factor in certain things like average earth below, average type of terrain and everything. So, you know, you got to take it all with a grain of salt, because I don't know what is average. Here, I haven't got an open field, a flat open field here. And, you know, you don't have conditions that are perfect. So it just gives you an idea that if this antenna is in the optimum, position somewhere up there or whatever, you know, good distance away from things, this is the way it's going to behave. But Dick, I'm with you. You have to really try it to like it. Over.
Now, the good news is that Steve is ahead of the game here, in my opinion, Mel. If I was using MiniNEC or NEC or any of the programs you have used, and I'm modeling an antenna on 20 meters, where it's very difficult to get an antenna even one wavelength above the ground, and therefore ground effects are significant. The advantage that Steve has is that at 900 megacycles, where his wavelength is 12.9 inches, he can easily put his antenna multiple wavelengths above the ground. That guy Steve that I know, he has the resources to mount that antenna 50 feet in the air if he wanted to bad enough. That's 50 wavelengths above ground. So therefore, ground effects are very secondary to him. So with that as a advantage, you have reason to believe that the NEC program does a pretty good modeling job once you remove the ambiguities of ground effects. And do you think when he plugs in those element lengths and diameters, it'll tell him with 95% accuracy what it's going to do, and he can play around with those lengths? The older mini neck program that you're using, if he wanted to go get a copy today, is it freeware to your knowledge somewhere on the internet? I'm anticipating the next question Steve's going to ask. How much is he going to have to lighten up his wallet in order to get a copy of it? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I know there's some freeware YO systems, how Yagi optimizing. The mini neck, actually, what it did, it didn't really, have to specify directly that it was a Yagi. It could be working. Actually, what you're working with is what they call wires. In other words, you're assigning wires. They don't care whether, it's wires made out of aluminum
or copper wire or whatever. Basically, that's what you're doing. You're putting wires into a type of dimension. And, it's pretty good. Listen, it's interesting. Let's put it this way. It's interesting to get you, as they say, into the ballpark. And then you could always twerk everything, tweak it, you know. And, when you build a thing, you're fairly close. No, don't get me wrong. It's a great thing to work with as far as, antenna programming. But I think now if you're going to work with Yagis, This mini-neck works with, wires of any type, dipole wire, vertical, anything, because it's only assigning it as wires. Now, if you go ahead and want to work with Yagis, you can get the YO, I believe it's available in shareware now. It's a Yagi Optimizer program. Take over.
Okay, so mini-neck, mini-neck 2, Yagi Optimizer, YO, he has access to those, and if he wants to look at past results of somebody who has used these modeling programs a whole lot of times, Mr. Sebick is the guy who has done that, a man who recently became a silent key, and I think he lived in the Tennessee area. Can somebody tell me Mr. Sebick's call letters, because I'm awfully forgetful. Right now, if you can, go ahead. Okay. Once you find Mr. Sebick's call letters, and you start Googling that, you'll find out that he has printed a whole lot of past articles that are on the internet available to you, where he's done a lot of modeling with these programs, and you can look at the results of those and decide you like them or don't like them, or use it for ideas. So good luck, Steve, with finding a modeling program that's not going to set you back a whole lot of money. Each of these modeling programs do have a learning curve, the way that you have to put the data into the program, the machine you run it on, the way you run it, whatever. There's a couple of steps in the beginning that'll slow you down a little bit, but antenna modeling of conventional Yagi-like structures and dipole-like structures, from what I'm hearing, people have had a lot of success with doing that. Over to you, Steve, before we go over to Joe for his question. Let's finish Steve first. KC2MDP, K2RIW, you got Steve.
Why,
Dick, you asked me about CBEC's call letters. Was that over?
I sure did. And Bernie, we heard you in the background. Go ahead, Mel, with CBIC call letters.
Okay, I got distracted for a minute. W4RNL, Romeo, Norway, Lewis, RNL, over.
Well done. So, if and you look him up on QRZ.com, I hope he's still there. In fact, there's a section of QRZ.com where you can look up past calls, even though the person became a silent key. You get his full name, address, and whatever. Start Googling his website. You'll find an awful lot of data. He has spent the last 10 years of his life doing computer modeling of all kinds of Yagi-like structures. So there's a lot of past history there you can tap into, and the price is right. Bernie, were you saying something at the time? Go ahead.
Dick beat me to it. I was just coming with the call letters. His website is www.cebik.com. It's a good place to start.
Well, good. Well done, Bernie. Okay, with Steve, with that as a URL, you're going to find an awful lot of data. So back to you, Steve, for any final questions before we go over to Joe. KC2MDP, K2RIW. Good question.
Very good, Dick. Thank you so much for your answer. Thank you, Mel, for the advice. The other guy, I do believe his name was Bernie, I do believe. I thank you. And, now I have a lot of looking up to do, and hopefully I'll find something that'll work for me. I originally had the AWRL, I think it was Yagi for Windows, and it worked pretty good, but it was just a pain in the neck to use because they segmented the elements, each element in like 8 different sections, and you had to take, a short element, a short element to 6-8 inches, and divide it by feet, or whatever the heck it was, 16, or whatever the parameters they had for it. So I'll definitely take a look at these websites, and hopefully I'll find something good, and I'll get back to you next week and let you know how I made out. Thanks again, guys.
Yeah, do come back, Steve, and let us know. Well, you're allowed to ask more questions on the subject. And this segmenting procedure that you described, maybe some of the later programs automatically do that for you behind the scenes, and you don't have to worry about the rigmarole of you doing it. But that is The finite element analysis process by which these programs work does do a whole lot of segmenting. And as you segment in finer and finer little pieces, that's one of the methods by which the answer becomes refined and gets a little bit more accurate. So, to my knowledge, they all do that to some degree. Joe, sounds like you've got a question on the subject on the table. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, W-H-Y-Y. Yeah, I have a question. I'm working on a transceiver for a friend of mine, and I'm just having a little bit of bewilderment of how the thing is working here. It's an old Yaesu transceiver. I'm getting about 225 mils on the plate for plate current, 800 volts plate supply voltage, and I'm only getting about 45 watts out of the tune position. And that's supposed to be equaling about 180 watts DC inputs. It seems like this thing is not very efficient, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, the way you worded your sign-in, Joe, you made it sound like you had a question of the subject that was on the floor. All right, you're signing in with a question, and there's one person ahead of you. So we're going to go to that person and then come back to you, Joe. Got to take people in the order in which they signed in. That's the rules of our little game here. And the next person who signed in, I think, was Bernie. My list, K2. I can't read my own writing, Brian. Brian, I think you signed in with a yes. And if so, please proceed. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Affirmative. This is Brian, K2EBD out of Lake Winconkoma.
How's that? I told you.
Go right ahead, Brian, from Lake Winconkoma.
Okay, yeah, I have more of an update, I think, with a little bit of a question about a couple of PC-1000 FM transceivers that was trying to get working, restore, and I've got both of them working pretty well, but one of them seems to have a little bit of an arcing across the trimming capacitor when I'm transmitting, and I'm not too sure if it's another capacitor down line, or possibly maybe the trimming capacitor is dirty, maybe corroded or whatnot. But the good news is they both work, and I'll wait for your comments on that.
Okay, I'm going to make a couple of guesses here, Brian. That this is a tube-type transmitter with a PI tank network. In other words, it has a real tuning and loading control, which are variable capacitors. Am I correct so far in what you're talking about here, Brian? Go ahead.
Yes, that's affirmative. It's a very old tube-type, one of the first FM transceivers they used in World War II.
Okay. I've been down that exact road where you are. That my 6-meter rig with a 4CX250B behaved in exactly that manner. I think it was the tuning capacitor that would arc over. And what makes a capacitor arc over is that the instantaneous RF voltage between the rotors and the stators of that variable capacitor exceeded the breakdown of that capacitor in its current condition. Now, there's two things that can make the voltage higher on that capacitor. Number one, you might have a high standing wave ratio of the antenna. When you do, the PI tank network has to work harder. It ends up, when you tune it correctly, with a higher Q, and therefore the voltages on the capacitors are raised. So if the antenna doesn't have a low enough standing wave ratio, that's one of the aggravating factors that can give you an arc over. Therefore, if you have access to a 50-ohm dummy load of the right power rating, let's assume now this is a 100-watt rig, and if you can get your hands on a 100-watt, 50-ohm dummy load, and you substitute that for the antenna, and if you don't get any arcing, that would be a strong indication of the first guess I'm making right now, that your tank circuit is running higher in Q because of a high standing wave ratio of the antenna. The second thing that can make the capacitor break down is because it has dirt and sharp edges. If you open up the case and with a good bright light and a magnifying glass, you look very carefully at the rotor and stator plates of the variable capacitor that is doing the arcing. Do you see dust and dirt and sharp edges and whatever? Maybe a thorough cleaning process, a good wire brush and cleaning fluid to get rid of all the dust and dirt on the plates might help. because the capacitor is as old as it is, and maybe it was made out of aluminum, and maybe some corrosion occurred around the edges, any sharp edge on a metallic object gives you a point of voltage concentration where corona discharge can start, and eventually that results in a complete arc over. So cleaning and getting rid of with a fine jeweler's file, let me drop, getting rid of any sharp edges. Again, with that inspection, you may see black marks where the arcing took place, and give a good hard look there. Is there something that you can see physically that looked like it was the initiator? So a low standing wave ratio antenna, a clean capacitor, these are the things that will frequently stop the arcing. Now, in my particular case, I was using an air variable capacitor beyond its rating. You could say that mine was good for 1,000 volts, and I was putting 1,500 volts of RF across it. The next step was that I got a hold of sheets of Teflon, and I made a bunch of sheets of Teflon carefully cut so that I could put them in between the individual rotor and stator plates of the variable capacitor, so that now when those plates were meshing, there wasn't air between the rotor and stator plates, but there was my sheet of Teflon. And that worked very well if and only if I used virgin Teflon. One of the well-kept secrets in the electronic world is that some of the Teflon you can get your hands on is really recycled Teflon. And recycled Teflon tends to have extremely fine microscopic pinholes, which might continue to get arcing. So if you get a hold of virgin Teflon and you cut those sheets correctly, you can stop arcing with that technique by putting it in between the plates. But that's the third step downrange, in my opinion, though, as I see it, Brian. So try the low Vizwire dummy load first, a good clean inspection, getting rid of the burrs, and by the way, the arcing over usually is not destructive, particularly as long as you don't dwell there for 10 solid minutes, if you know what I mean, and overheat your tube. But of course, if it's annoyance, you'd like to eliminate it, and now you know a little bit more about what causes it and how to slow it down, I think you're going to be able to stop it. When you do, you're going to come back and tell us about it, Brian. K2 Echo Victor Delta in Ronkonkoma, K2RAW in TechNet.
And to an anyway, with a question.
We're going to get to Alex right after Brian. Brian first, go ahead.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. I'm leaning right now towards the dirt on the aluminum trimming capacitor. I believe it is made out of aluminum, and I can probably bet that most likely it is dirt. I've got two units, and I've switched the antennas back and forth. I have a whip antenna and a shorter one with a loading coil on it. And each way, there was arcing across the trimming capacitor. So I'm leaning towards the dirt most likely. I think that's probably what it is. As far as the Teflon, I'll have to get back on that. I think I need that. I have no idea where I find that. But in the meantime, I've got them both working, and I appreciate all your help and your answers. Thank you.
I don't know if there are sheets of Teflon in the bubble packs at Radio Shack. There should be. McMaster catalog certainly has it. A lot of catalogs will have sheets of Teflon. So getting your hands on it is not too difficult. A good cleaning job, a good visual inspection under a large magnifying glass and a bright light, and then getting rid of the burrs that you can see physically with a jeweler's file, all of these techniques will definitely help. The Teflon approach is sort of a last resort. Assuming that the radio design worked properly in the past, I don't think you should have to use the very enthusiastic technique of adding the sheets of Teflon. I'm just telling you that's what I did because I was pushing the rating of that particular variable capacitor I was using. Alex, what would you like to know about all this? N2NNU, K2RIW.
A basic question, why is it that sharp tips and sharp edges are favorizing corona discharge? Do we know the mechanism that is producing?
Oh boy, do we. As you study your field and wave courses in many of the colleges in the United States, quite often on the final exam, they'll give you a flat plate with positive voltage on one side and a oddly shaped plate with negative voltage on the other side, and they want you to draw the field lines of what is the voltage distribution in the free space in between those two plates. And you start off by drawing a bunch of lines that are perpendicular to each of those surfaces. When you look up close, you start off with lines that hit each of the surfaces in a perpendicular manner, and then you draw another set of lines orthogonal to those, and then depending on the way you show up with the way you do this procedure, and as a whole multi-step process, you'll end up finding out that a sharp point is always a point of high voltage concentration, E-field concentration, when electrostatic breakdown is being studied. If you owned a Van de Graaff generator or a Wimshurst machine, these are machines that will make 100,000 volts of electrostatic voltage at very low current, and you can study it, and you put a sharp point on one side, you'll see all kinds of little miniature lightning bolts coming away from that sharp point. Whereas if I have two very large diameter rounded objects and I bring them close together, they will tolerate an extremely large amount of voltage without arcing over, whereas a sharp point will not tolerate that. So I know I haven't given you the whole answer. However, if you just Google the word high voltage experiment, and I've done that, and you start studying the articles that are on the internet, this will start becoming a little bit more obvious. There's also a number of articles by the Berkeley College. Let me drop. The whole series of science articles by Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, very well illustrated. Some of these are animated. I mean, you can actually look at an RF wave, the E field and the H field of the RF wave propagating in space as a YouTube animation, so to speak, by one of those Berkeley sites. So it's a reality. You have to accept it. And the more blunted the objects are that are coming close together, the higher the voltage you can put on them before they will arc over. Maybe that helps a little bit, Alex. N2NNU, K2RIW.
I guess my question was why. All the mechanics that you described are well known to everybody, but why is the field that we're talking about favorizing this mechanical structure as a tip? This is not explained anywhere. Besides, we don't really know what the field is there in this moment of time. We think there are some vectors there, but we don't really know what is that. It's electrical or mechanical or whatever manifestation is. All right, well, I guess we'll wait for those guys in France to restart the accelerator. back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you've really challenged me here, Alex. From time to time, I say that the real good scientist doesn't want to know what happens. He wants to know why. And you're asking why. You're right up my alley. You tickled my fancy. Let me make another stab at it. Let's assume that I've got a whole sea of electrons, and one of them is painted red, and I'm looking at the one red electron. And I'm going to put him into two separate environments. In the first environment, I'm going to put him right on the surface of a completely flat sheet of copper. And maybe it's really the very large diameter sphere, but up close with my magnifying glass, when I look at this guy, he thinks he's on a flat sheet. He's really on the surface of a very large metallic sphere, a globe. And so the adjacent electrons that are alongside of him have to be on the surface, as far as the effective ones are concerned, and he's got some electrons to the north of him, to the south of him, to the east of him, to the west of him. But all the electrons that are on the surface of this metallic conductor are coplanar with this red electron. That's the first environment. And so as I increase the voltage potential between these two very large diameter spheres that I'm bringing close together, the chances of that particular electron being pushed off the surface by his adjacent electrons that are giving him electrostatic repulsion, it's pretty small. It's a pretty small probability that he's going to be pushed off that surface. Now let me put my red electron in a second environment. Let me drop. My red electron, I'm now going to put him on the sharp tip of a needle. And when I do that, his adjacent electrons that are on the surface of that needle are down the slopes of the needle from him. He's on the very tip, on the sharp tip. And those adjacent electrons are down on the slope. Those electrons are behind him, so to speak, as far as the E field in front of him. There's a flat plate in front of him with high voltage on it. And so because those electrons are down the slope behind him, their electrostatic repulsion is pushing him forward, really enthusiastically pushing him to jump off of that needle and start creating a corona arc in space. So if I look at it that way, where are the adjacent electrons that are repulsing him? And if some of them are behind him on the slope of that needle pushing him forward, he's going to have a much higher probability of jumping off as opposed to the nearly flat surface. I wonder if that helps a little bit. It's a heuristic approach to the problem. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Oh yeah, it helps. However, there is always this fantastic however. At the microscopic level, there are no tips for the electron. He is in a vista. He is in a steppe, Russian steppe. For it, there is no tip. So I see what you're saying. However, it's hard to believe that there will be enough energy to push it off the surface in the free space when all the forces are telling it to stay glued to the metallic surface. I think you see that for the red electron, there are no tips.
Okay, but bear in mind now that I've got a flat metal plate that is positively charged near this negatively charged needle. And my red electron, your and my red electron, is sitting on the tip of that needle. Because of the presence of that positive plate nearby, it's applying a strong attractive force to all the electrons that are on that needle. Therefore, not only are the majority of the electrons behind the red one that I'm studying, who's right on the tip, I know you're saying there is no real tip, but I'll keep making the tip sharper and sharper, and eventually he's the one electron right on the tip. No matter how sharp you make a needle, I'm going to make one a little bit sharper, Alex. But I've got this positive plate nearby, which is attracting these electrons, and as such, when all of the adjacent electrons start crawling up that needle, they have the ability to get much closer to that positive plate. They're being attracted to it. And in the process, they're getting much closer to the red electron that I'm studying. They're not only behind him, pushing him forward with their electrostatic repulsion, but they are piling up behind him, and they're very close to him. As opposed to if I put the red electron on a negatively charged flat plate, the concentration of the electrons around him is not as dense, and they are essentially coplanar with him. They don't have as much of a phenomena of pushing him forward. Maybe that helps a little bit. I know it's not the whole answer. Over to you, Alex.
Okay. As you're talking, I tried to imagine your tip, and suddenly came in my mind that electron scanning whisker. They have those little tips that actually are the electron size. All right. Well, I think it's more to it than that, because whenever an electron is breaking free of the material in which it's embedded, because the electron is not just on the surface of the material, it is the best of the worst case that can be for it. It is to be half embedded; otherwise, it will not circulate anywhere. There are forces that will attract this electron into the material. So all the electrostatic forces that we create must be larger than the forces that attract your red electron in order to expulse it from the material itself. Ah, well, I'm too tired for this discussion. I started at it something that I really didn't want to. But I will take what he's saying, take it back to you.
And don't be discouraged, Alex. That's a darn good question. It's a question in the vicinity of the things that I have been asking recently. I want to get a greater understanding of what's going on at the molecular level. I've done some experiments where I think with a little more understanding at the molecular level, I'll be able to make variations of the circuits that I'm building.